Book for Luggage Stolper presents Leadership in Statecraft, Studies in Power, edited by Kurt Almqvist, Alistair Benn, and Matthias Hesserus. Read by me, Helen Lloyd. The Enduring Secret to Cyrus the Great's Success by Ali Ansari. It is a peculiarity of current scholarship that given the longevity of the Persian Imperium in its various manifestations over 1,000 years from the 6th century BC to the 7th century AD, and the impact of Persian ideas of government in the wider Islamic world, greater attention is not expended on Persian statecraft and ideas of leadership. It was not always thus. When British administrators from the East India Company sought to govern the legacies of the Mughal Empire, it was Persian they learnt and Persian ideas of government that they absorbed. Earlier Muslim dynasties, not least the Abbasid Caliphate, were also enthusiastic students of Persian ideas of kingship, defined as it had been by a moral code and an intimate relationship with religion. They were enabled in their appropriation by the Persian bureaucrats who came to staff their burgeoning bureaucracies. But perhaps most striking was the admiration of the Greeks, the very people whose confrontations with the Persians has come to define our understanding of the West and its tensions with the barbarian East. Yet for all the popularity of the Persian Wars as the foundational moment in the narrative of the ascent of the West, the attitude of the Greeks towards their Persian rivals was a good deal more respectful than modern perceptions allow. We tend to focus on Alexander the Great as the epitome of leadership and empire building, despite the fact that the empire he built was inherited, and the man he admired was Cyrus the Great. Cyrus loomed large in the Greek imagination, as someone who had achieved what their own political experience had suggested was impossible. As Xenophon explained in his largely fictive account of the education of Cyrus, the Cyropaedia, though some historians now argue that Xenophon was merely recounting the Persian account of Cyrus, distinct from that provided by Herodotus, which had over time become more mythic and heroic, the Greeks could not but conclude that man is by nature fitted to govern all creatures except his fellow man. Yet Xenophon continued, "When we came to realize the character of Cyrus the Persian, we were led to a change of mind. Cyrus, we know, found the readiest obedience in his subjects, though some of them dwelt at a distance which it would take days and months to traverse. And among them were men who had never set eye on him, and for the matter of that could never hope to do so, and yet they were willing to obey him." Just how Cyrus managed to bring together peoples from as far afield as the Oxus to the Aegean, and to command their allegiance, was an achievement which both awed the Greeks and demanded an explanation. Xenophon's explanation, meanwhile, was to prove one of the most influential manuals for government, beloved by aspiring statesmen down to the period of the Enlightenment. But it was another book that served to popularize Cyrus in the Western imagination and to hint at the secret of his success. This was, of course, the Bible, where Cyrus was one of only two leaders to be accorded the title Messiah in the Old Testament, the other being King David, on account of his liberation of the Jews from the Babylonian captivity in 539 BC, one of the central myths of emancipation within the Judeo-Christian world, which retained its potency in our more secular environment on account of its apparent religious tolerance. Historians have since criticized such idealized accounts of Cyrus and the attempts to ascribe liberal motives to his empire building. But as Greek writers testify, his dominion clearly represented something different. And this distinction is exemplified in the biblical account, which suggests that Cyrus was not only unusually political in his empire building, but also aspired in some way or form to a moral code and purpose. We may rightly question what that was, But there is little doubt that Cyrus approached his task with a degree of political subtlety which escaped his Babylonian and Assyrian predecessors. A brief look at Assyrian bas-reliefs will show scenes of war and bloodshed, extolling the military virtues of the conqueror and serving as a terrible warning to those who might oppose him. Go to Persepolis, the ceremonial capital of the Persians, and the reliefs are quite different. There are bas-reliefs of guards, but instead of scenes of war, we have subject peoples lining up to pay tribute, not in bondage, but in apparent harmony. Some are even shown holding hands. This, of course, also goes to the heart of what Xenophon seeks to explain, how Cyrus and his immediate successors, at least, were able to convince a diverse and dispersed collection of peoples that the dominion of Persia was not only something desirable, but reflected the right and natural order of things. What we see here, in essence, is the construction of authority as the basis of power, as the basis of a political rather than a military imperium. This is not to say that the Persians did not exercise military force, but it was selective rather than routine, and did not serve as a central pillar of their dominion. Of the three Persian empires, Achaemenid 559 to 330 BC, Parthian 240 BC to AD 224, and Sasanian, AD 224 to 642, that held sway in the ancient world, the Achaemenid was the most extensive and arguably the least militarized. It could, as Xerxes' invasion of Greece in 480 BC indicated, mobilize forces on a tremendous scale. But as a rule, it did not maintain a large standing army, and, as Xenophon experienced and recounted in his Anabasis, it was possible for an armed force of rebels to exit the heart of the empire effectively unopposed. The Persians justified their dominion on the basis of good governance, law, and access to justice, underpinned by a moral purpose. This provided for a harmonious existence as explained and provided for by a Zoroastrian worldview. In the Achaemenid period, this worldview enjoyed more flexibility and fluidity than it was to have later, but some basic themes already existed. The duality of creation and man's function as a key aspect of the wise lords, Ahura Mazda, good creation to partake in the battle against evil, and the wicked creation of Ahriman. Mankind was an agent in this struggle, in which the king was the best among men, and the link between the material and the spiritual worlds. This moral universe was perhaps best encapsulated by a prayer of Darius the Great, in which he beseeched Ahura Mazda to protect his people from the lie and keep them in the service of the truth. This is reflected in Herodotus' claim that Persian youths were all taught to ride, shoot the bow, and tell the truth. The truth represented the good order, which was in turn reflected in the king as the chief representative of Ahura Mazda. To rebel against the king, therefore, was to rebel against the truth and the right order, and deserve the swiftest and most violent of punishments. This moral universe was not a matter of debate. It justified and supported the political order and reinforced the authority of the king. It provided a political clarity that proved attractive in an otherwise chaotic world. The biblical statement that the laws of the Medes and the Persians, which altereth not, can be seen as both boast and warning, but it is above all clear, and people knew where they stood. The Greeks, on the other hand, revel in a disorder that Herodotus has Cyrus decry as bewildering. I have never yet been afraid of men who have a special meeting place in the centre of their city where they swear this and that and cheat each other. For the Greeks, this Persian order represented bondage. For the Persians, it represented common sense, as long as governance was good, administered with moderation, and above all, just. The centrality of justice, which also relates to balance and harmony, was key to Persian statecraft and offered them an explanation for failure. As long as the Achaemenids survived, there was no need to explain why the good order might fail. But Alexander's conquest was not simply a military failure, it was also a moral one. Indeed, Persian failure has rarely relied on military explanations alone, preferring to see this as an aspect of deeper moral collapse, or, to use a Western expression, decadence. This leads us to another important aspect of statecraft and leadership that came into focus in the post-Achaemenid period and was acutely defined under the Sasanians: the contingency of divine grace, Fare Izadi. The king represented the great agent of the divine will on earth and was Ahura Mazda's chief lieutenant in the struggle against the lie. All mankind, of course, had a role to play, but the king's was the most important. If, however, the king strayed off the true path into the lie, suffered from hubris and failed to dispense justice, then he too might lose the divine grace. Moral turpitude would inevitably lead to decline and fall. Good behaviour would enhance one's moral capital and reinforce the protective grace. Bad behaviour would see that protection withdrawn. It was incumbent on the monarch, therefore, to behave well, and unlike other theories of divine right, or indeed straight divinity, there was no such concept of absolute loyalty to the king. Bad, unjust kings deserved not only to fall, but to be opposed and overthrown. Many of these ideas were refined and redacted during the late Sasanian period, most notably during the reign of Khusrau I, Anushiravan, 531-79. Khusrau became emblematic of the just king, such that long after the Achaemenids and Cyrus had receded from Persian memory, he was credited with every achievement of the ancient period, barring those assigned to mythical times. It was Khusrau's rule that became emblematic of just rule during the Caliphate, and a manuscript recounted by the British soldier diplomat Sir John Malcolm in the early 19th century relates how the Abbasid Caliph Harun al-Rashid discovered Khusrau's tomb, where he acquired the secrets of good governance. Naturally, the Caliph then decided to destroy the entrance to the tomb so that no others could discover it. Whatever the veracity of this tale, and there are many reasons to doubt it, it testified to the attractions of Persian ideas of government in the Islamic world, and it is quite clear that Sasanian ideas of statecraft and leadership cast a long shadow. This reflected the moral core in these Persian ideas and the centrality of religious belief, all of which meant that these ideas would translate and adapt quite easily to the new Islamic rubric. Indeed, a favourite among Muslim rulers were the words ascribed to Ardashir I, the founder of the Sasanian dynasty, on the close relationship between religion and kingship. "Know that kingship and religion are twin brothers. There is no strength for one of them except through its companion, because religion is the foundation of kingship, and kingship the protector of religion. Kingship needs its foundation, and religion its protector, as whatever lacks a protector perishes, and whatever lacks a foundation is destroyed." These ideas were burnished and disseminated by the large cohort of Persian bureaucrats who staffed the administration of the Caliphate, as well as successive dynasties. The Sasanian Empire had, of course, been completely absorbed into the new Caliphate, unlike the Byzantine Empire, and as such, its administration was effectively swallowed whole. Persian administrators populated the entire establishment, from chief vizier down to the local bureaucrat. Few converted, and many championed the old ways of doing things, as recounted by the Arab satirist Al-Jahiz in the 850s, who noted how the Persian bureaucrat, never tired of boasting about the admirable way the country was run under the Sasanians. Among the more popular sayings ascribed to the Sasanians was the Circle of Justice, which decreed that authority and order depended on money, which required cultivation, trade, which in turn required justice and good governance, which required authority, and so on. There were many variations on this theme, with some longer and more detailed than others, but all noted the imperative to maintain justice such that, in time, the primacy of justice over all other attributes became established. One might tolerate a heathen king, but never an unjust one. The most famous of these bureaucrats was Nizam al-Mulk, the chief vizier to the Seljuk Sultan in the 11th century, whose manual of government remains required reading for many in Iran and the wider Muslim world to this day. Nizam al-Mulk drew on a range of sources for his manual, including the history, as he understood it, of pre-Islamic Persia. He was assisted in this task by the fact that a near contemporary of his, the poet Ferdowsi, had compiled the histories of pre-Islamic Persia in a single epic poem for the ease of recitation, charting the ascent of man through to the fall of the Sasanians. This epic, known as the Book of Kings, Shahnameh, was probably the single most important means of transmission of Persian ideas of government and ethics, and was wildly popular in the Persianate world and beyond, including notably among both Mongols and Turks. The consequence of this was that Persian ideas of statecraft and leadership were absorbed among both the Mughal and Ottoman administrations, along with the Safavids in Iran itself, where they were inherited by successor states, not least the East India Company and its Indian civil service. Meanwhile, the biblical Cyrus remains popular in Israel and among Christian communities in the United States. Many of these ideas have naturally been superseded by ideas of political thought and governance more suited to the complex dynamics of our own age. Attempts to ascribe modern sensibilities to ancient forebears rarely work, despite the best efforts of modern leaders, and certainly few ancient monarchs have enjoyed such a consistent positive reputation as Cyrus the Great, even if his own kinsmen had forgotten about him over time. Yet for all the simplicity of the ideas, they retain a force and value of use to this day. The moral purpose, centrality of authority, and necessity of justice. Good governance must enjoin harmony, balance, and a measure of moderation. A government will only survive, and indeed thrive, if it is consistently in pursuit of its moral goals. An unjust government cannot survive, and will deservedly fall, losing the divine grace and moral purpose that sustains it. It is not without reason that Cyrus and the Cyropedia were so popular among Renaissance princes and their Enlightenment successors. Perhaps it's time to become reacquainted.